I always say, if you cut yourself within a couple of weeks, the repair is perfect and you go back to normal. How is it possible that inside of the body we don't have any of this, right? So we just develop outside the repair mechanism, but inside of the organism, we do nothing about insulin resistance, liver, fatty liver, inflammation. There is no way, right? So the body has these repair mechanisms. We just need to learn how to trigger them and trigger them in a way that can result in repair and regeneration and we believe also rejuvenation.
This is episode number 112 with Dr. Valter Longo. This episode is brought to you by ButcherBox. Now, I don't know about you, but over here in Cleveland, I am starting to get very excited about summertime, which means it's almost time for one of my favorite things, grilling season. Growing up, my family had a cottage in northern Michigan, and some of my fondest memories are evenings gathering with friends and family on the porch for a big barbecue after a long day of boating, swimming, and tubing on the lake. The more I learn about health, the more I've come to believe that it matters so much where our food comes from, and particularly when it comes to meat. I believe that meat can have a place in a well-rounded diet, but there's a huge difference when it comes to animals that are raised in feedlots and that are fed primarily corn and soy and routinely given growth hormones and antibiotics versus those that are responsibly raised, fed their natural diet, and never given growth hormones or antibiotics. High-quality meat like this is hard to come by, but ButcherBox makes it super easy by delivering 100% grass-fed and finished beef, free-range organic chicken, heritage breed pork, and wild Alaskan sockeye salmon directly to your doorstep. All of their products are humanely raised and never ever given antibiotics or hormones. This gives me a lot of peace of mind, knowing that I can trust my meat and seafood is the highest quality out there and will taste amazing. Plus, they offer free shipping anywhere in the contiguous 48 United States. How amazing is that? So, after 3 years of living in our house, my husband Danny and I are super excited to finally be finishing off our tiny little backyard this spring, and I can't wait to fire up our grill and enjoy our ButcherBox meats with tons of vegetables from our local CSA. And now you can join us, because ButcherBox is extending an awesome offer for Pursuing Health listeners. $20 off plus an ultimate barbecue bundle for free with your first box. Now, the bundle includes 2 New York strip steaks, baby back ribs, as well as 2 pounds of ground beef, which is a $59 value. Supplies are limited, though, so you'll want to order now to take advantage of this offer. You can go right to butcherbox.com/Julie to place your order. Once again, that's $20 off plus the ultimate barbecue bundle, 2 strip steaks, baby back ribs, and 2 pounds of ground beef for free with your first box by going to butcherbox.com/Julie. If you're looking forward to hosting your first backyard barbecue of the season as much as I am, hopefully you'll check this out. Have you tried out Thrive Market yet? If not, you are definitely missing out. What are you waiting for? Thrive Market is an online marketplace on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable for everyone. It allows you to shop for thousands of the best-selling non-GMO foods and natural products, always at 25 to 50% below retail prices. But as a Pursuing Health listener, you'll receive an additional 25% off your first purchase, plus a free 30-day trial if you visit www.thrivemarket.com/PH. My husband Danny and I shop for our staple grocery items using Thrive Market. Things like nut butters, cooking oils, snacks, dressings, coffee and tea, personal care products, eco-friendly cleaning supplies, and non-toxic beauty products. It has helped us to stay on track with our busy schedules during medical training, and we know all of their products are coming from a curated list that we can trust. So, no matter what you're looking for, whether it's paleo, vegan, ketogenic, gluten-free, non-GMO, fair trade certified, or any of 80 plus other types of products, you can easily find them on the Thrive Market platform at prices 25 to 50% below retail. Even better, these items are shipped straight to your doorstep, so you don't have to worry about the time or hassle of grocery shopping. Thrive Market's mission is to make healthy living easy and approachable to everyone, and this aligns perfectly with my own personal mission and that of Pursuing Health. Because it has been such a lifesaver for me, I wanted to share the benefits of Thrive Market with all of you, and they've responded with an amazing offer. So head to www.thrivemarket.com/PH to receive 25% off your first purchase plus a free 30-day trial. Again, this is on top of their already 25 to 50% below retail prices. So why not try it out and do your grocery shopping from home this week? I hope you can take advantage of this offer and enjoy their service as much as I have. Once again, that website is thrivemarket.com/PH to learn more. No discount code is necessary. Just shop around and the discount will be applied at checkout. Welcome to Pursuing Health. I'm Julie Fouché, family medicine resident and former CrossFit Games athlete. Here, I bring to you information and inspiration from experts and everyday individuals for how to use lifestyle to maximize health. Thank you so much for joining me. Now let's get started with this week's episode. Hey there, welcome back to Pursuing Health. In this episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down with one of the world's leading researchers of longevity, Dr. Valter Longo. A little bit about Dr. Longo. He is a professor of gerontology and biological sciences and the director of the Longevity Institute at the University of Southern California. He is also the senior group leader of the IFOM Cancer Institute in Milan, Italy. His studies focus on the fundamental mechanisms of aging, and they range from molecular studies in simple organisms in mice, all the way up to the translation of these findings to humans in large epidemiological studies and clinical trials. After nearly 25 years of research along pioneering scientists in longevity, Dr. Longo has applied his extensive knowledge on aging, genetics, nutrition, and disease to develop the longevity diet. He believes that by following a low-protein pescatarian eating plan combined with periods of a fasting-mimicking diet, one can improve their cellular rejuvenation, increase their resistance to metabolic disorders such as diabetes, autoimmune diseases, cancer, and neurodegenerative diseases, as well as extend their healthy lifespan. I recently had the pleasure of catching up with Dr. Longo to learn more about the five pillars that guide his longevity research, and how his research has led him to believe that the key to increasing your youth span lies in making long-term, sustainable changes to your nutrition. One of the things I love about Dr. Longo's approach is that he's taking the most up-to-date research findings and making them accessible to patients and the general population through things like his book, The Longevity Diet, as well as the ProLon Fasting Mimicking Diet. However, he doesn't collect a penny from either of these efforts, and 100% of royalties from his book and shares from his company go straight back to supporting high-quality nutrition research around the world through the Create Cures Foundation. Before we get started with this episode, I have a few quick reminders. First, this episode is produced by CrossFit Beyond the Whiteboard, the best workout tracking in the biz and the one I've been using since 2009. You can learn more at beyondthewhiteboard.com. If you're enjoying the podcast, please head over to iTunes to subscribe and consider giving it a rating. I'm also always looking for inspiring stories to share. So if you or someone you know has used lifestyle to overcome a serious health challenge, please send your story to me at info@juliefouché.com. Finally, please remember that although I am now officially a doctor, this podcast is meant to share the experiences of individuals and does not provide medical advice. So with that, we'll get started with episode number 112 of Pursuing Health featuring Dr. Valter Longo.
Welcome to Pursuing Health. I'm very excited to be here with Dr. Valter Longo, who is one of the world expert researchers in longevity. So thank you so much for joining me.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I was reading a bit about your background, and it sounds like you have a very interesting background that in some ways influenced you towards your research in this field. So I thought maybe we could start there and maybe tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in Italy and then what brought you to the States.
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to grow up in two places, maybe 50-50 between southern Italy in some of the areas that now by chance turn out to be some of the longest lived in the world. They're small places that are not, people always, when they think about Italy, Sardinia or Calabria, these long lived places, they think of big areas. They're in fact small towns, and these small towns happen to have record longevity, some of the longest lived people in the world. And then there was the Calabria, in a particular small town called Molocchio, And then Liguria, where Genova is, and you know, it's known for the Cinque Terre and that area around Genova, but it's really one of the areas of the world that has the highest over 65 population, and also is one of the areas of the world that has always had a pescatarian diet, and so a fish plus vegan diet that is to this day normal for people. This is what they eat. And not too many places in the world that have this specific diet just by historically having had that type of selection. And so then I think I was lucky to have that that background. And then when I was 16, I moved to Chicago. And so there was, at least at the time, this was like mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And so the Chicago represented like a really bad, there was certainly a really bad diet back then. And now I guess they're still not so good, but it's particularly bad back then.
Okay.
And, and then from Chicago, a few years later, I moved to Texas. And that, I think I went from bad to worse and then ended up in California in the laboratory of Roy Walford, who was the world at the time, the world leading place, a leading scientist for longevity and nutrition. So I went, I guess from traditionally very, very, very good to very bad in Chicago, even worse in the Tex-Mex diet in Dallas. But then to the California, like this really ideal longevity type diets that Walford was working on. So that I think really shaped the way that I started thinking, not just about science, but it was always science plus tradition. And this really shaped everything we do.
Mm-hmm. And I think you talk a bit in your book just about noticing changes in the health, maybe, I don't know if yourself, but of some of your relatives after they had moved to Chicago and their diet had changed from their traditional diet. What were some of the things that you observed at that time?
Yeah, a couple of things were diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And so most of my relatives were 100% Italian. You know, they genetically, they just came from the same place. And I started seeing them develop all these problems that I really didn't see in my Italian family. That was already very telling, because the only real difference that I could see, and it was a huge difference, was the diet. And everything else, it wasn't so much different.
Mm-hmm.
My relatives in Chicago were fairly active, you know, and so they didn't have necessarily sedentary jobs, but they were still struggling. And the diet was most likely what made that difference.
Okay. So you had some of those observations. And then at what point did you decide that this was what you wanted to do? You wanted to do research on longevity.
I always wanted to do research on longevity. I think since early on. And so I switched to I studied music, jazz performance, actually, in Texas at my first year of college. Mm-hmm. And then the second year, I moved to biochemistry department. And from the beginning, I studied biochemistry. Then at some point, I said, I want to study aging. My decision was I want to study aging. And then I thought as a 18-year-old, how do you do that? And I thought, well, if you study chemistry and you study biology, and therefore biochemistry, probably can't go wrong, you know. And that was a very good decision, by the way. I mean, at 18, you know, just don't go into biology and don't go into chemistry. Try to get, really what's pretty much a double major of biology and chemistry, the biochemistry. So it was always my interest. I always thought there was like nothing more that would make me more enthusiastic than than to study aging. And I think from early on, I was surprised that people, didn't see there was like an incredible scientific challenge. This mystery, everybody's always been interested, you know, why we age and die. And then I thought, this is also, it's got to be very fundamental for diseases, you know, for medicine. And so then that's what made me very, very sure that that's all I wanted to do. And that's all I've ever done.
Amazing. Amazing to have that insight so early on in your career. I think many people, it takes them much longer to figure out what it is they want to do. So then can you talk a little bit about what it was like in the early years, you know, after an undergraduate, and then I think you were able to work with, like you said, some of the world experts early in your career. What was that time like, learning from them and kind of developing the direction that your research would take later on?
Yeah, so I, Los Angeles at the time was the Mecca and in the aging research, and I don't know why, but certainly two of the pillars of the pioneers of longevity were here, Roy Walford and Caleb Finch, who's, by the way, is next door to me still to this day. He's almost 80 years old.
Wow.
And so I think that I came and I visited both labs, and then eventually I decided to join the Walford lab for my PhD studies. And eventually I joined the Finch lab for my postdoctoral studies. So this was the really an incredible place. And I was lucky enough when I joined the Walford lab to, he was in, at the time he was in Biosphere 2, it was an area in Arizona that, where they had done the first, calorie restriction experiment. And so I was lucky to be there when they exited Biosphere 2. And so that was a great experience. And so this is basically the first human experiment on calorie restriction, meaning that they had gone into this place in the middle of Arizona, and they stayed in there for 2 years, and they stayed in there while they were calorie restricted. So they ate about 30% less than normal. And the results were really extraordinary. I always talk about this, both the bad results and the good results, right? Mm-hmm. So that experiment that they did that really, really showed how good calorie restriction is and how bad it is, all in one study.
What were some of the good things and then the bad things that you learned from that?
Well, the good was that if you look at the results, you will say medicine is getting it all wrong, you know, so that you could see that it completely changed fasting glucose, it completely changed cholesterol, triglyceride, it completely changed blood pressure. Everything was revolutionized. So, so you know, if a cardiologist will see that, if you saw those changes, right, and you were a doctor, you would say, what kind of medicine are you taking? You know, and you say, before and just a couple months into Biosphere 2, into this calorie restriction, they would think, you just have an incredible cocktail of drugs that are doing everything right. And you know, of course, it was not a single drug. It was all the type of food and the quantity of the food that they were eating. So they were, you know, very much on a vegan-like diet, but also the quantities were very low. So, yeah, so I think it revolutionized their risk for diseases. At the same time, if you look at them, you will say, you're not going to do very well. You know, so, and that was really the incredible part about this study, that it just visualized the solution and the problem in just one, especially Walford, because Walford was the oldest, and he was close to 70 years of age when he went to Biosphere 2. So I think that did most damage to him, you know, being this big, pushed to the limit and being pushed to almost an anorexic-like state. So I think that that picture really worth a billion words in that case, was really a great way to start my PhD and to shape the next, 25 years.
Well, amazing that, you know, that just the sacrifice that they made to do that research on themselves, but also interesting, so that your research advisor was actually in this Biosphere too while you were doing your research. That must have added a little bit of challenge as well.
Yeah, I mean, it had a challenge, but I think that it really also shaped my, you know, the way of doing things. I really like Walford's style mm-hmm. of, yes, we're doing research, but here we are, you know, myself yeah. in a biosphere too for 2 years. He was really, doing experiments on himself. And so that I think was great for me. Very different style from that of my future mentors, mm-hmm. but one style that I really adapted probably a lot and really shaped my career.
That's amazing. And I want to come back to that too later when we talk about some of your fasting research and how that influenced your direction. But you've also really taken an approach of, you know, where often in medicine we're focused on specific diseases or like you've mentioned before, longevity in terms of the years of our life, but you've really taken a focus on looking at health. And I think you've termed it juventology. We're looking at what is the science of what makes us healthy and vibrant even as we age. And I'm curious, what influenced you to take that approach or look at your research through that lens?
Yeah, so I think that, my colleagues, the people that study aging now, lots of us talk about health span, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's the point of living to 100 if starting at age 55, you're sick?
Right.
And so there is the concept of health span. I thought that I wanted to add something called youth span. And, you know, to gerontology and health span, mm-hmm. I wanted to add youth span and juventology. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, there's something very different. So how long can we keep somebody young for, right? So young in the sense of, you know, being able to play sports at a somewhat competitive level, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where juventology comes in from. And I think it's very important that we focus on both, because really I talk about longevity programs. And so in the longevity program, so let's say there is a lot of talk about, say, functional food or drugs. And the problem that I have with this whole idea of, let's say, I give you a drug for a long time and this is going to make you healthier or longer lived, or I give you a functional food and it's going to make you... The problem I have with that is that sort of not looking at the sophistication of the longevity program. So a mouse lives for 2.5 years. And that mouse has a program that is much more sophisticated from the one of a fruit fly that lives for 60 days or so. So then I always thought, what we really need to focus on is on the understanding how do you go from 60 days program to 2.5 year program to an 80 year program for humans. And so if we can understand how the program works, but particularly if we can understand the not pushing the program, you know, the reprogramming is going to happen. It's just a matter of time. It might take, you know, 500 years, 1,000 years, I don't know. But it's going to take a long time. But the interesting thing is, what if there are multiple programs, right? And for yeast, for example, some of my, eventually I left the Walford lab because I wanted to understand the molecular biology of aging, right? Mm-hmm. In yeast, there are three preset programs. One, that it lasts about 5 days, where yeast live for 5 days. Then there's something called stationary phase, they live about 15, 17 days. And then there's something called spore state, and they live for years, right? I always thought from the beginning, I looked at this and say, that's a 100-fold difference in life, right? 100-fold. Yeah. So, and here we are talking about vitamin C, right? And so I said, you know, this is what I want to figure out. You know, how do you go from 5 day to 500-day lifespan? Just by changing program, and the program has been, I call it, you know, 3 billion years of research and development, meaning like this has been developing for billions of years. Mm-hmm. That's how sophisticated it is, right? So I thought that's what we want to figure out. Let's figure out how do you go from program A to program B to program C. And once we can figure out a switch, now we can have tremendous effects on certainly on, you know, these 20, 30 years of sick lifespan. I mean, that I think we're already there. But eventually, we can do even better than that.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I love the very comprehensive approach that you take with your research in looking at this from so many different angles and bringing that all together to make it, try to understand it and make it practical for the layperson to understand as well. And in your book, you talk about five different pillars of longevity that are sort of different ways that you study this. Can you outline those for us and why they're each important to get a really comprehensive understanding?
Yeah, so I, of course, especially when you start talking about nutrition, everybody says, oh, you know, here's another book and another opinion on nutrition.
Right.
Really, I waited for 25 years before writing the book because I understood that the pillars were so important. So, you know, pillar one, of course, was the reason for my switch from the Walford Lab to the biochemistry department. And it was, you have to understand the fundamentals. If you don't understand how organisms work, then you are going to be lost from the beginning, right? So it was important to understand the genes, identify the genes that control longevity. So I told you this lifespan of 5 days, 17 days, and then 2 years. Well, my first effort was to identify some of the most important genes that extend lifespan. So we identify two genes that together with starvation will make yeast live 10 times longer. Right? So that's a pillar of basic research focused on longevity. Then you have to go to epidemiology. You have to say, well, okay, you know, this pillar shows these genes are important, show that the protein pathway is important, for example. What about people that eat lots of protein? Are they doing worse? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what you do. Then you start looking for, you know, how do people that eat lots of protein compare to the ones that eat low protein to the one that eat no protein, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that if you eat too much protein, you don't do very well. If you eat low protein, you do very well. If you eat no protein, you do very badly, right? Mm-hmm. So you're starting to see like this, a common denominator, these two pillars matching. Mm-hmm. And then you have to move forward and say, well, okay, what about clinical studies? You know, if I do a clinical study, if I put lots of people on a high protein diet and, you know, 50 people and 50 people on a low protein diet, what do I see? You know? And in a randomized controlled clinical study, it's a gold standard. And that's important because you want to have that kind of like rigorous comparison, right? Mm-hmm. If blinded, even better. If placebo controlled, even better. Not necessary, but certainly. And so that's pillar number three. And then I think that, you know, pillar number four is the centenarians is also very, very important. Why is that? Let's say, for example, the low-carb diet. Everybody now talks about low-carb diet. And you could say, well, first of all, if you look at basic research at low carb is not good. If you look at epidemiological research, low carb is not good. If you look at clinical research, low carb could be quite good, right? Mm-hmm. So lots of clinical studies say, you know, low carb diet after 8 weeks or whatever you do there, you lose weight, you lose your lower cholesterol, et cetera, et cetera. But then you say, well, what if I look at centenarians, you know, some of the longest people in the world, do they have low carb diets? And you really don't see that almost in any of the, like, certainly the record longevity groups. You know, that doesn't mean that there couldn't be somebody around the world that has a low carb diet and is, you know, a population that is low carb diet and lives particularly long. But it's not common at all, right? So so that's when you, even if you believe that the low carb would be good, you say, why is it that I don't see the people living to 100, 110? Or longer having low carb diets, maybe it's not so good. So that's pillar number four. And pillar number five is complex systems or systems that are complex. I don't want to say complex systems anymore because a complex system refers to something, there's a scientific terminology for a complex system, which is usually system that you don't understand, like the brain is a complex system. But I mean, systems that are complex are very important because, you know, I think of cars and planes. Mm-hmm. And make you know, sometimes you want to simplify the biological system even further into a machine that you actually built, like a plane, and that allows you to make some conclusions about. For example, I always say, you know, should you run? Or should you, as far as exercise is concerned, should you run or should you do biking or should you do something else? How much of it should you do? Should you do like what if somebody ran 100 miles a week? Is that good? Right? If you look at the other pillars, you don't really get a great answer. I mean, you get some answers, but not a great one. It's not very clear. Then you start looking at complex systems and say, well, if a car has 200,000 miles on it, would you buy, right? Most people say no, and say, well, why not? You know, they must have changed tires. They must have done lots of good things to it. Yeah, but, you know, it's been worn out. That's what everybody will say, right? So this is where the fifth pillar come in is, you know, we, at some point, we also behave like systems that are complex. And then, you know, you can learn a lot from these machines because they're made of material that can be damaged. And they can wear out, and they can teach us about our own wearing out.
I love it. So looking at sort of different fields to inform what we're studying here, which often I think can provide some information. So based on all of these different pillars, which you've accumulated, you said how many years of research?
Yeah, but, over 25 years.
Over 25 years. So obviously being very patient and waiting until you have all this information before you're writing it up in a book and doing lots of hard work without kind of sharing it. I mean, sharing it, but not in the sort of public way of the book that you recently wrote. What are sort of the key things that you've learned about the ideal diet that we should be following for longevity from all these different pillars?
Yeah. So then if you put it all together, I think you come up with a pescatarian diet. Why pescatarian, not vegan? Well, I mean, one of our jobs is to not just say, you know, I have a diet. And if everybody came and lived in a hospital or in Biosphere 2, mm-hmm. that would be great, right? It doesn't work like that. You're going to go out there and you're going to tell people and they do what they do with it, right? So I think the vegan diet, lots of people may be malnourished on the vegan diet, whether it's B12 or protein deficiency or some of the minerals, etc. They may be malnourished. So pescatarian, there is really, beside the ethical argument, there is really nothing that I've seen that will say that fish a couple of times a week has got any negative effects. All I've seen, or the great majority of the studies, will suggest positive effects of let's say two meals a week that contain fish or seafood. So that looks like it's important. And then, you know, a low protein but sufficient protein diet, about 0.35 or so grams per pound of body weight. So if you weigh 100 pounds, that'd be 35 grams of proteins. Mm-hmm. If you weigh 200 pounds, it'd be maybe not quite twice as much because, you know, usually people that weigh 200 pounds may have high fat percentage composition. So, you know, it might be 60 grams per, you know, 200 pound person. And high carb, about 60-30-10 seems to be the ideal. If you look at meta-analysis and you look at it, put it all together, mm-hmm. it's just pretty consistent, actually. You know, for example, recent meta-analysis now shows that even an 80% carbohydrate diet is better than a low carbohydrate diet. You know, if you look at lifespan. So 60 seems to be the ideal. So 60% carbs, 30% fats, and 10% of the calories coming from proteins. That seems to be ideal. Where the most of the carbs should come, if you can do it, or as much as you can do it, from, you know, vegetables, a little bit of from fruit, and then, you know, the rest of it can come from starches. Now, you know, there is lots of research now about gluten, about inflammatory components, about mm-hmm. so yeah, for the people, some people, a small percentage of people, and you could argue that some people argue that the percentage is much bigger than the small, mm-hmm. like say celiac disease, but if you have, for people that have gastrointestinal issues, then you need to pay attention in a very different way from everybody else, right? Mm-hmm. The gluten could be a problem, lots of inflammatory components. So this diet that I just described may not be as simple or as straightforward to do as for everybody else. But for everybody else, this seems to be a good way to go. So lots of vegetables. So I talk about, for example, eat more. I mean, people always introduce me and say, he's going to tell you eat less. Mm-hmm. And this is what my boss did, Walford. But I always say eat more. What does that mean? It means that the ideal dish would be, let's say, 50 grams of pasta and then, you know, 300 grams of chickpeas, and then another 200 grams of mixed vegetables, you know. So think about, you know, an ounce is what, 28 grams, right? So, you know, just for people that don't like grams. And That seems to be ideal. And then I talk about 12 hours, you know, time restricted feeding, eat within 12 hours a day. You know, lots of people are now starting to go 16 hours of fasting, 18 hours of fasting. Doesn't seem like to be such a good idea. Why? Because you start seeing problems when you go to 16, 18 hours. You know, for example, people that skip breakfast do worse than anybody else. And people that go 14, 16, 18 hours a day of fasting, they seem to have gallstone formation that is higher and gallbladder operation that is much higher than everybody else. So stick with 12 hours. So if you have breakfast at 8 a.m., by 8 p.m., you need to be done eating. If you like to have late dinners, then have late breakfast. You know, so 9 a.m., 9 p.m., if it takes until 9 p.m. to be done, and then stop eating after that. And then, you know, I always say if you're overweight or tend to gain weight, forget the 5 or 6 meal a day ideas that we've been hearing for so long, and stick with 2 meals a day, breakfast plus lunch or breakfast plus dinner, and then a healthy snack as your third meal. You know, it could be nuts, it could be a salad, it could be, you know, anything that it's healthy as a food. Then fats should be mostly, you know, unsaturated, the olive oil, the salmon, the nuts, walnuts, hazelnut, almonds. Yeah, so that's that seems to be the ideal diet. And then the last thing is the periodic fasting mimicking diets. And so, you know, between, let's say, a couple of times a year to 12 times a year or so, depending on where you begin. So if somebody's obese and has high cholesterol, high blood pressure, this 5-day fasting mimicking diet, they're ideal. And there is one that is commercially available called Prolong by the Nutra. I should say, I don't make a penny out of it, but I am the founder of the company. Yeah, so I think those are doing the fasting mimicking diet, you know, between twice a year to 12 times a year seems to be ideal. And the twice a year is for people, let's say somebody's 35 years old, an athlete, has a pescatarian diet, yeah, probably sufficient to do it twice a year. Not very many people that are in that situation, but I think there are people. And and also I think it's important to keep in mind that fasting mimicking diet should be done when you need to do it, you know. So I don't like it when people start improvising and start saying, oh, you know, this is good for me, so I'm going to do it every 2 weeks. Doesn't work like that. Eventually, you're going to see the problems of that kind of behavior. So it's better to stick with, you know, if you have a problem, yeah, you might need to do it once a month. If you don't have a problem, you know, and everything is perfect, don't have anything to solve, then a couple times a year should be fine.
So more is not always better with that one. Okay, I want to dig into some of the things that you talked about. So first one being protein, because I think especially a lot of listeners to this podcast probably eat a lot more protein than you had recommended. And I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit about why, maybe some of the mechanisms about why high protein can have a negative impact. And if you make any changes for someone who is like an athlete or doing a lot of weightlifting or things like that.
Yeah, so the protein control, if you take people and you remove the protein, you'll see the growth factors, particularly IGF-1, or keep dropping down. And then together with IGF-1, you'll see TOR, and other AKT, et cetera, they'll be downregulated. And so those are some of the genes that we now know to be pro-aging, meaning that they promote, accelerate the aging process. And they also accelerate cell growth. And so they're very much associated with all kinds of cancers and all kinds of other problems. So this is the reason to keep protein low, aging, but also cancer and other diseases. It also, if you look at muscle synthesis, lots of data indicates that if you have 30 grams with one meal, and you do some muscle exercise, that pretty much, those 30 grams pretty much maximize muscle synthesis. Mm-hmm. So the most you could do if you were a bodybuilder, based on those studies, would be do it twice a day, right? So to do 2 30 grams, so 60 grams, mm-hmm. do 2 training sessions, and that will maximize the muscle building. Now, you know, I think that there can be, for professional athletes, for example, there could be higher protein intake that might benefit some in some particular situation. So, you know, I don't want to talk about, performance, but certainly in general, it doesn't look like, based on human clinical studies, it doesn't look like, you know, having 150 grams of protein and all this protein craze, all these commercials that you hear about protein, is helping anybody. At the same time, of course, there are people that are protein malnourished. And for those, you know, somebody that eats salads twice a day, mm-hmm. doesn't have any proteins or very little. Mm-hmm. And so those should then have, you know, make sure that they move to the minimum, let's say 30, 35 grams a day of proteins, because otherwise in the long run, they're probably going to have a mm-hmm. problem.
So maybe kind of just making sure you get that 30 grams after the workout, but then not necessarily needing to get that much protein at every meal. And I think the important distinction you made between performance and longevity, sometimes those do not always line up, sort of the short-term performance goals versus long-term health.
Yeah, so lots of athletes do very poorly longevity-wise, right? So if you keep pushing certain pathways and certain genes, you might end up with lots of maybe temporary benefits, but then lots of damage that you pay for the rest of your life, you know. So I think it's you gotta do what you gotta do, but you know, always keep it in mind that that some of these excessive you know, whether it's diets or practices, can have lifelong effects.
Mm-hmm. And then how do our protein needs change then as we age, or some, maybe even some of our other nutrient needs change as we get older?
Yeah, so in a study that we published a few years ago, we noticed that the people who are 65 and younger reporting low protein intake, they did very, very, very well. And but the people that were like 70, 80, 90 years old, and they were reporting low protein intake, very low protein intake, mm-hmm. they did not do so well. We think that, and we also saw in mice, if you feed mice very low levels of proteins, if they're young mice, they're okay. Mm-hmm. If you take all mice, you give very low level proteins, they struggle. And so this is suggesting that as organisms get older, having a little bit of extra protein, it doesn't mean having twice as much, but certainly a little bit more protein, maybe going from the 0.35 to 0.4 grams per kilogram of body weight, per pound of body weight per day. So that might be ideal. Try to not, as people get older, try not to lose muscle mass. Try to keep a steady lean body mass weight. Most people don't, you know, so most elderly, they keep losing muscle mass, and this is not good. So. So certainly in our cancer trials, we see that when you give them sufficient proteins and also you combine this with some muscle exercise, the lean body mass not only stays the same, but it goes up. Mm-hmm. So this suggests that the combination is very important, even in the older people. So have enough proteins, not excessive, and then do some muscle exercise.
Okay. I'm curious too on your take on a ketogenic diet, since that's sort of a hot topic right now. And you had mentioned earlier some of the very low carb diets having maybe some promising short-term outcomes, but not necessarily long-term, and what you think the role might be for a ketogenic diet. Is it something that may be useful for short term for certain medical conditions, or for certain people, is it useful? for a longer term?
Yeah, so the longer term, I would say that if somebody could, the data indicates if somebody could be, if it can be vegetable based, this ketogenic diet can be mostly vegetable based, that seems to be fairly positive, right? So if you have, a low carb diet that is also vegan or vegetarian, that seems to be okay. The data for the regular diets, you know, lots of sausages and eggs, et cetera, and meat, low carb, that's consistently bad. Beside these beneficial effects, short term, and like weight loss, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so then I think, and I wouldn't do it. I mean, I don't think it's a good way to get to where you need to get. I'd rather do the, say, fasting mimicking diet and then have this longevity, this pescatarian diet, eat a lot, et cetera, et cetera. There are better ways to get there. But, you know, I have lots of colleagues, doctor colleagues, that they say, I had people with problems and I put them on a low carb diet. I try to push the vegetarian or vegan food as much as possible. And my patients do very well. You know? Yeah, so I think that it's possible that somebody could use it for like 2 or 3 months, use the low-carb ketogenic diet as vegan as possible, and then switch them back to a higher-carb diet that is much more longevity benefit.
Okay, so maybe in the short term for certain medical conditions or, I mean, I've seen studies for things like obesity, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, to kind of get people on the right track, and then over the longer term, they, you know, once they're more metabolically healthy, to adopt a little bit higher carb diet.
Yeah, and even that is tricky, right? Because, you know, for example, there's lots of data now that's coming out of clinical trials suggesting, what if you put somebody in, let's say, 600, 800 calorie diet for 3 months, right? And it looks great, right? The benefits seem to be great, and they can reverse diabetes and this and that. The problem is that you now, lots of data suggesting that you're going to slow down metabolism. And if you do that, then A, you put the people on a diet that they hate. Two, B, you now slow down their metabolism. And so you're really condemning these people to do even worse after that, right? Because eventually they're going to say, there's no way I'm going to continue this diet. And B, now that I decided that I'm not going to continue this diet, my metabolism is slower than when I started. And so now I am condemned to regain all the weight and regain the problems, if not even worse, right? So you need to be very careful with these short-term intervention ideas, right? Because unless you're sure that this can have unless you can make changes in people that you think they can keep for the rest of their lives, I think it's better to leave them alone. You know, we know that these yo-yo diets end up making it worse for the patients. So I think it's better to, you know, let's say with the way we're using now fasting mimicking diet is in the following way, is to say, if you take somebody obese, pre-diabetic, for example, and we give them these 5 days of a vegan diet, low calorie, et cetera, et cetera. What we see is then we basically say in 5 days, you're going to go back to whatever it is that you always ate. We don't touch it. But then after 3 or 4 months and after 2 or 3 cycles, we start seeing people saying, you know what? You never taught me to change my diet, but I don't feel like eating as I did before. Right? I don't feel the need to have as many steaks as I had before, or many sweets as I had before, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that's really the future. Instead of imposing something so dramatic that people are going to hate it and slowing their metabolism, is use these diets that seem to be accelerating the metabolism. They do the opposite, right? Because it's short and it doesn't have this effect, which may be epigenetic, in slowing down the metabolism. So give it to them. Don't overburden them. Then 1 month, 2 months later, when they're ready again, do it again, do it again. And then eventually they're the ones that are going to say, I feel better with this diet. I'm not sure why, but I feel better. And my instinct bring me in that direction. I want to keep feeling like that. And I'm going to go slowly to a diet that I'm fine with and that nobody imposed on me. that makes me feel more like that. Mm.
So the difference between the fasting mimicking and some of these more extreme diets, you think, is mainly in the length that it's, you know, because I wonder about that. Obviously, fasting mimicking, it's short, but it still is a big change for people. But you think it's just the short length, and then they allows them to kind of slowly shift and recover and change their eating preferences over time?
Well, I mean, of course, the fasting mimicking diet is a fasting mimicking diet. So mm-hmm. it mimics fasting. The other diets don't mimic fasting, right? The ketogenic diet, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So they're very, very different. But I mean, a big, big difference is, in fact, the keep it like a medicine. You mm-hmm. take it for 5 days and then go continue to do mm-hmm. what makes you happy. Don't have a long, low-calorie diet that is going to have these long-term effects on the metabolism. Mm-hmm. And also, don't disrupt my diet because then it's just a matter of time before I rebel and go back to whatever it is that makes me happy. Mm-hmm. So I think that, the idea is keep it short and allow people to make the decision on their own to move gradually towards the longevity diet that I described earlier.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, as you had mentioned earlier, you saw some of the negative impacts of that long-term, very low-calorie diet from Dr. Wolford, and eventually you came to this idea of the fasting mimicking diet. Can you just talk a little bit about kind of how it works from a biological perspective and what you think that it's doing to your body and your metabolism?
Yeah, so from a biological perspective, the main thing is, of course, we do lots of work with mice. Mm-hmm. So we have lots of data, molecular data, and cellular data. What it looks like it's doing is essentially shrinking the system, and then in the shrinking process gets rid of lots of things that are damaged, right? And it makes sense, right? You're going to get rid of cells and in intracellular component, you're going to grab first the ones that are damaged. Mm-hmm. But then... Once you shrunk and you're smaller now, version of yourself, and the food comes back around, you re-expand. And when you re-expand, you go and utilize the same mechanisms that you use when you're first born, so during embryonic development. And again, going back to what I said earlier about longevity programs, these are developmental programs. So you're not exploiting, again, 3 billion years of research and development. And you're allowing this very sophisticated system. For example, we in a mouse, we can damage the pancreas. And then we start the fasting mimicking diet refeeding programs. And you see that the pancreas, the cells of the pancreas are reprogrammed and go from not being able to make insulin to start this gene expression that is normally only seen in mice that are just first born. Yeah. And then this gives rise to pancreas that and beta cells that make normal levels of insulin, right? So really it's a self-repair regeneration mode that seems to be happening everywhere in the body. And it makes sense, right? Because mm-hmm. when you're starving, every single cell of the body and every single organ is going to be affected. It's going to have to go into a saving mode. And then when you refeed, you reverse all of this, and you want to re-expand and go back to the normal size, right? So now imagine a war prisoner that, some of them had BMI 14, right? So imagine somebody BMI 14 now make it to BMI 30, mm-hmm. right? In that process now, this person has doubled or some of the organs may have tripled in size. And so that means that most of the organ is brand new, right? Mm-hmm. And it was just built. And so that's a remarkable thing. It's so simple. And yet we talk about transplants and we talk about, lots of sophisticated regenerative intervention. And almost nobody's talking about the body is able to regenerate almost anything. It's just not very easy to get it to do so.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. So you're actually seeing in your studies that the organs are shrinking over the course of this 5-day period or so with the fasting mimicking, and then they're actually able to regenerate, get rid of the diseased cells, and regenerate with new healthy cells.
Yeah, so we've seen this for multiple sclerosis mouse model. We've seen it for inflammatory bowel disease model. We've seen it for the diabetes type 1, diabetes type 2. So we keep seeing it for a lot of different systems. Mm-hmm. We really start thinking it must be everywhere in the organ, in the organism. And then in the clinical trial, we do see lots of evidence for that. You know, when we did the human clinical trials, whether it was multiple sclerosis or normal people, we see the lowering of cholesterol or blood pressure, lowering of fasting glucose, inflammation goes back down, leukocytosis goes back down. It really is hard to explain it in any other way than what we also see in the mouse, which is the body is able to use this moment to look for problems around and fix it, right? So I always say, if you cut yourself within a couple of weeks, the repair is perfect and you go back to normal. How is it possible that inside of the body we don't have any of this, right? So we just develop outside the repair mechanism, but inside of the organism, we do nothing about insulin resistance, liver, fatty liver, inflammation. There is no way, right? So the body has these repair mechanisms. We just need to learn how to trigger them and trigger them in a way that can result in repair and regeneration and we believe also rejuvenation.
Amazing. And do you see similar effects from doing a complete fast versus the fasting mimicking, and why did you go towards the fasting mimicking diet?
No, the complete fast reminds me a lot of calorie restriction, right? Good and bad. Right? So the complete fast, of course, is going to give you a lot of benefits, and it's going to give you a lot of problems. It's going to give you hypoglycemia. It's going to give you possibly hypotension. So very common that we see people that were only fasting, they pass out. Also, in the latest study that we published, we compare water only fasting with the fasting mimicking diet, and we saw that it was something very interesting. When you did water-only fasting, the gut became more leaky, right? So it increased, together with the toxin that caused inflammatory bowel disease, they increased the leakiness. And it probably is because the water-only fasting gives the message to the gut to break down because there is no food. With fasting-mimicking diet, you didn't see that, and you actually saw less leakage, and it's probably due to the ingredients of the fasting-mimicking diet, which are contributing to the microbiota, to the microbes in the gut. For example, lactobacillus, when we feed the bacteria, when we have. So it looks like these good bacteria are using the combination of the fasting with the content, with the vegan content, to give rise to this very protective bacteria population. Yeah, so... I mean, there's all kinds of reasons to not do water-only fasting, but these are just some of them. And I think it's just people need to understand, don't improvise. It's a mistake, and improvisation will get you the effects of calorie restriction. Lots of good and lots of bad, and people always talk about the good. And of course, something bad happens, we don't find out about it until maybe somebody dies or something like that. And in fact, there was one case in Italy, a lady... did multiple sclerosis, did 3 weeks of water-only fasting, and she ended up dead. So what happened, nobody knows, but certainly very bad idea to improvise with multiple sclerosis and do this very long water-only fast, and the result was tragic.
So you want just the right stimulus. Where would someone go if they have one of these conditions, or maybe they just want in general to improve their longevity, to do the Prolon fasting mimicking diet, or to learn more about how to do this?
Yeah, I don't remember the site name, but I think it's Prolon FMD. Mm-hmm. But if somebody put Prolon and the name Alnutra, Nutra, they could find it. And, all my part, it goes back to charity and to clinical trials and to universities. You know, so I think people always complain about, why do the pharmaceutical world, they have so much money and the government gives so much money for pharmaceutical research and for the nutrition, we have no money. Right. And so this is also an opportunity for us to have some of the funds to fund lots of studies around the world that are focused on nutrition and are focused on some of these ideas that are, combining both technology and tradition. I think we need to, so I'm just saying, by buying Prolon, you also sponsor.
It's going to a good cause.
Sponsor the ability that we and many others will have to continue to do research and help people not just prevent diseases, but also we're about to publish a series of trials with cancer One of them is, you know, the biggest one we've done so far, very effective. I cannot talk about it too much, but certainly for breast cancer women, it made a big difference. And so I think we're going to still, you know, it's not going to be successful for everything, but certainly it looks very, very promising for lots of diseases.
It's exciting. We look forward to reading all the upcoming research. I know we have to wrap up. I just wanted to ask three quick questions that I ask everyone at the end of the podcast. You can give me your rapid fire answers if you'd like. So the first one is the three things that you do on a regular basis that have the biggest positive impact on your health.
Yeah, so three things, certainly the pescatarian diet, you know, eating 12 hours a day. I do usually 8 a.m., 8 p.m. or so. And then I will say the fasting mimicking diet, you know, I do it a couple of times a year because of all the other things that I do. But yeah, people just have to find the right level.
Very good. So practicing what you preach. The next question is one thing that you think would have a big impact on your health, but you have a hard time implementing it.
Not eating sweets, you know, and yeah, so I like to have carbs that are relatively simple, starches and things like that. Yeah, I think if I reduced it, I would do better. And maybe, you know, more exercise, more muscle training. I always say I'm going to do it. But I do a little bit of it, but not very much. So I wish I put some more effort into that, but I don't.
Fair enough. And then the last question is, what does a healthy life look like to you? A healthy life, yeah. What does that look like to you?
A healthy life? You mean in terms of longevity or?
Yeah, how would you describe a healthy life?
Well, a healthy life to me would be a life where, you know, you're fully functional, you have to have no diseases, and you're not worried about any diseases. And so I think you could be pre-diabetic, can be somebody could say you're healthy, but you're not healthy. You know, if your fasting glucose is 115, you get a problem. And so, yeah, I would say it should be that you're fully functional, you don't have any diseases, but there is also nothing that suggests that you're about to get a disease. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for this conversation, and thank you for all the amazing research you do. I think it's wonderful how much you're sharing it with the world. I think so many times this cutting-edge research gets lost in scientific meetings and in debates amongst the world experts. So I really appreciate how much you're sharing that and bringing this information out to the world.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey there. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode. I got so much out of this conversation with Dr. Longo. I just wish we had more time to dig into the details of his research. Here are three of my biggest takeaways from our conversation. Number one of my takeaways was definitely Dr. Longo's recommendations about protein intake. When we look at athletic performance, we're often hearing recommendations about very high protein intake, sometimes upward of 2 grams per kilogram per day, which is much more than Dr. Longo recommends in this episode. It makes me ask the question, how much protein do we really need to continue to build muscle and promote strength without also promoting inflammation and risk of disease? Once again, these concepts of what's best for short-term performance and what's best for long-term longevity may be at odds with each other. I like Dr. Longo's approach for athletes of consuming most of their protein post-workout and shifting more of the protein intake to fresh, low mercury-containing fish like salmon. My second takeaway is about the power of time-restricted feeding and the fasting-mimicking diet on cellular regeneration. I've talked with previous guests about the impact of time-restricted feeding on circadian rhythms and the gut microbiome from research out of Dr. Sachin Panda's lab. But the concept of cellular regeneration that Dr. Longo is observing with a fasting mimicking diet is fascinating, and it makes so much sense. It's also very interesting to me that this may be more beneficial than a straight water-only fast, and that the dosing of the fast, limiting it to 5 days every few months, is very important to get the desired response. You can definitely overdo it by doing too much. I've personally experimented with time-restricted feeding myself, as well as some longer fasts up to 24 hours, but I'm very excited to give the fasting-mimicking diet a try with the ProLon FMD protocol in the near future. I'm also interested in continuing to follow Dr. Longo's research and further applications of this diet for patients who may be suffering from various conditions from metabolic disease to autoimmunity. My final takeaway from this conversation was the concept that our dietary needs change over our lifespan. Dr. Longo discussed this, especially with reference to protein requirements, as we know that older individuals benefit from higher protein intake. But once again, this just reinforces the concept that nutrition is not one size fits all, and likely the ideal diet for each of us is slightly different and changes over the various stages of our lives. So I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did and were able to take away some points just like me. To make sure you never miss an episode and to receive exclusive content from me, head to my website, juliefouché.com, and subscribe to my email list. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe and consider giving the podcast a 5-star rating on iTunes. Also, don't forget to share your stories. If you or someone you know has used lifestyle to overcome a serious health challenge, please send me an email at info@juliefouché.com. I'll choose some of these inspiring stories to share here on future episodes. Don't forget you can train with me through Beyond the Whiteboard by visiting trainwithjuliefouché.com. Thank you again so much for listening, and I'll catch you next time on Pursuing Health. This episode is brought to you by ButcherBox. Now, I don't know about you, but over here in Cleveland, I am starting to get very excited about summertime, which means it's almost time for one of my favorite things, grilling season. Growing up, my family had a cottage in northern Michigan, and some of my fondest memories are evenings gathering with friends and family on the porch for a big barbecue after a long day of boating, swimming, and tubing on the lake. The more I learn about health, the more I've come to believe that it matters so much where our food comes from, and particularly when it comes to meat. I believe that meat can have a place in a well-rounded diet, but there's a huge difference when it comes to animals that are raised in feedlots and that are fed primarily corn and soy and routinely given growth hormones and antibiotics versus those that are responsibly raised, fed their natural diet, and never given growth hormones or antibiotics. High-quality meat like this is hard to come by, but ButcherBox makes it super easy by delivering 100% grass-fed and finished beef, free-range organic chicken, heritage breed pork, and wild Alaskan sockeye salmon directly to your doorstep. All of their products are humanely raised and never ever given antibiotics or hormones. This gives me a lot of peace of mind, knowing that I can trust my meat and seafood is the highest quality out there and will taste amazing. Plus, they offer free shipping anywhere in the contiguous 48 United States. How amazing is that? So, after 3 years of living in our house, my husband Danny and I are super excited to finally be finishing off our tiny little backyard this spring, and I can't wait to fire up our grill and enjoy our ButcherBox meats with tons of vegetables from our local CSA. And now you can join us, because ButcherBox is extending an awesome offer for Pursuing Health listeners. $20 off plus an ultimate barbecue bundle for free with your first box. Now, the bundle includes 2 New York strip steaks, baby back ribs, as well as 2 pounds of ground beef, which is a $59 value. Supplies are limited, though, so you'll want to order now to take advantage of this offer. You can go right to butcherbox.com/Julie to place your order. Once again, that's $20 off plus the ultimate barbecue bundle, 2 strip steaks, baby back ribs, and 2 pounds of ground beef for free with your first box by going to butcherbox.com/Julie. If you're looking forward to hosting your first backyard barbecue of the season as much as I am, hopefully you'll check this out. Have you tried out Thrive Market yet? If not, you are definitely missing out. What are you waiting for? Thrive Market is an online marketplace on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable for everyone. It allows you to shop for thousands of the best-selling non-GMO foods and natural products, always at 25 to 50% below retail prices. But as a Pursuing Health listener, you'll receive an additional 25% off your first purchase, plus a free 30-day trial if you visit www.thrivemarket.com/PH. My husband Danny and I shop for our staple grocery items using Thrive Market. Things like nut butters, cooking oils, snacks, dressings, coffee and tea, personal care products, eco-friendly cleaning supplies, and non-toxic beauty products. It has helped us to stay on track with our busy schedules during medical training, and we know all of their products are coming from a curated list that we can trust. So no matter what you're looking for, whether it's paleo, vegan, ketogenic, gluten-free, non-GMO, fair trade certified, or any of 80 plus other types of products, you can easily find them on the Thrive Market platform at prices 25 to 50% below retail. Even better, these items are shipped straight to your doorstep, so you don't have to worry about the time or hassle of grocery shopping. Thrive Market's mission is to make healthy living easy and approachable to everyone, and this aligns perfectly with my own personal mission and that of pursuing health. Because it has been such a lifesaver for me, I wanted to share the benefits of Thrive Market with all of you, and they've responded with an amazing offer. So head to www.thrivemarket.com/ph to receive 25% off your first purchase plus a free 30-day trial. Again, this is on top of their already 25 to 50% below retail prices. So why not try it out and do your grocery shopping from home this week? I hope you can take advantage of this offer and enjoy their service as much as I have. Once again, that website is thrivemarket.com/ph to learn more. No discount code is necessary. Just shop around and the discount will be applied at checkout.